author of the week with Jessica Burtis, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
So what age should you really consider actually settling down? Well, maybe it should be 25, or at least over 25. How do we come up with this? And how can you actually use a love match model to check out whether indeed you are actually ready for the big relationship? In any case, well, we've got not just one, but two fabulous individuals to talk about this particular topic. First of all, we have from indeed the University of Queensland, indeed former senior lecturer there, and indeed also member of the New York Academy of Sciences. That's George Blair West. How are you, George?
Very well, thank you, Alex. Thanks for having us on.
Excellent. And we also have, of course, your daughter, who you co-authored this particular book with, How to Make the Biggest Decision of Your Life, Unlocking the Secrets to a Healthy, Lasting Relationship. That's the fabulous Jiminy. So the key question is the Blair West Love Match Model. George, would you like to tell us, first of all, how you came up with this whole process in the first place?
Sure, Alex. This comes from working with couples for 25 years now and realizing that a lot of the times when they come to see me with significant issues in their relationship, I could trace them back to beginning before they got married. And when they were dating, the red flags were there. The issues around incompatibility were there. And I realized that we've really got to rethink the whole way in which we look at this, going right back. You know, if we're going to prevent divorce, we've got to go right back to the beginning and look at how attraction works and what we can do to avoid going down the path of a relationship that actually doesn't have a future.
Back in the day, of course, here in England, John Milton, of course, known for Paradise Lost, had a major disagreement with his wife, who, of course, was a keen royalist, whereas Milton was very much on the side of the Republicans. And Milton obviously argued then in favor of divorce. So we've moved on a wee bit since then. A few hundred years later, here we are with approximately 42% of the marriages in the United Kingdom end in divorce, according to the Office of National Statistics. Jiminy, from your own point of view, what interested you in the first place in terms of becoming co-author of this particular element?
Yeah, well, I work with single people. So being single is really the perfect time to start thinking about these bigger issues that, you know, I know Dad has the couples come in when their marriage is already on the rocks, and it can be really difficult to move forward from there, particularly if one person already has a foot out the door. So him, through his work, it was very inspiring to understand that you can actually see a lot of the red flags early on during the dating phase. And as a lot of my work is with single people, it's the perfect time for people to start considering and maybe even shift their mindset around how we approach dating these days, because a lot of people are waiting for love to happen to them. And as we talk about in our book, true love is something that you build over time.
George, you've had over a quarter of a century of experience dealing with this particular side of things. Do you feel as though we're getting better or worse, or is the 21st century, the me decades that we've actually had, is that harmful in terms of, you know, that illusion that perhaps Hollywood puts forward about couples settling down, being happy ever after?
Alex, this book nearly did not get written because when I spoke to my generation, which is the last of the baby boomers and Generation X, there was very little interest in the idea that we could rethink, re-engineer the way in which we fall in love and choose our partners. And it was actually the millennials, my daughter's generation, after I gave a talk, it was the millennials who were really interested to understand what could they do to avoid divorce. Whereas my generation, they just didn't think it was something that we had control over. They really saw it as being about romantic destiny, as we call it, as we talk about it in the book. And I realized that it's these younger, you know, 20-somethings these days, they're really interested in doing it differently. They're two generations into a divorce-ready culture, and they recognize that there are some fundamental problems around the whole idea of finding the one and romantic love.
Jiminy, from your own perspective, what was it like working with your father on this? Was that a case of, well, okay, we'll do it because it's a matter of course, or did you feel as though actually it was a natural development to actually start putting this whole process together?
You know, I did wonder how it would go when we started this project, and I have to say I was pleasantly surprised, and I feel like it really helped to deepen my own perspectives. I mean, it's such a gift to be able to draw upon someone who has, you know, 25 years of experience in this area. And it really enabled us to explore. A lot of things change in life, but some things also don't. And it's a really interesting intersection relationships because they are evolving and they are changing slowly. But to knock heads around our different generational perspectives and experiences, I think is really valuable and a really powerful experience.
George, you've come up with a magnificent seven steps that actually make up this particular test that can actually possibly lead to lasting happiness or a disaster, and you should get out of there as soon as possible. Would you like to take us through some of the key aspects and how indeed the notion of dressing down, not up on a date, or indeed asking about your dates at dates X, or indeed revealing an embarrassing fact about yourself could be, unlike kind of previously received wisdom, don't do that, they could actually be essential to actually making sure that you do have a long-lasting relationship.
Yes, so this model came out of both my clinical work and some really fascinating research on what we call the modern arranged marriage. Now, these are marriages typically in California, which is where the research was done, where the two partners had some involvement in the selection of their partners and they had power of veto. And what they found was these match-made arrangements that started off with very low levels of love, when you came back at 5 years, they were actually coming up to around the same level as love marriages, which were actually on their way down in terms of rated levels of love, such that at 10 years, the modern arranged marriage was having much higher, around double the levels of rated marital satisfaction. And that got us to look really closely at what happens in these marriages that allows you to build love over time, and what can we see back in the dating phase. So one of the biggest issues here is that people early on when they're dating are trying to impress. They're trying to be something that is really not who they are. And that actually slows down the process of actually working out how compatible you are. So one of the key things that we're talking about here, or a couple of them, you know, approach this, which is the whole idea of not trying to be something that you're not. But what the modern arranged marriages really teach us is the involvement of other people. They will see things in a potential partner, problems in terms of how well you come together, that you can't see yourself because of the unconscious aspects of the way in which attraction works.
Shivani, you're married, based in Sunshine Coast, Australia. I mean, the seven steps that make up this test, were they ones that you put into practice from your own point of view, or had the book not been written there?
They hadn't been written yet, but I definitely drew some inspiration. These were things that I was doing throughout dating, and that taught me a lot around how I had been, well, I had to recognize for myself how some of the strategies that I was using to date in the past were not actually yielding the results that I was looking for. And I have been able to bring some of that experience forward into the work. And so I do stand by a lot of these steps that make up the Blair West Match model.
In fact, maybe you could talk a bit about the whole thing about not being too cool for school and being more vulnerable, because that's, I think, one of the key ones that you work with your clients around too, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I love what you've said before, Dad, around a lot of people talk about communication being so important to relationships. And as you would say, a more specific word would be vulnerability. And so often people can communicate around vulnerability. We don't want to jump off that ledge and actually be vulnerable, except it's through the vulnerability and through our imperfections that we're actually relatable and that we can actually bond and build a connection. So it's so, so important. So when we say something like, you know, share an embarrassing fact about yourself, it's about that willingness to be vulnerable and that willingness to see if someone that you're dating is able to meet you there.
We often talk about the term authentic when it comes to individuals or relationships and so on. Is that a case of very much the truth setting us free, that actually maybe our parents and grandparents were actually right in terms of how these things can actually be developed, et cetera, and that, you know, the whole notion of watching how potential partners handle messages is actually quite positive in terms of reliability and ensuring that you've actually got a sustainable bedrock for your marriage. George, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes. So this issue of reliability, which is definitely something you can start to assess while you're dating somebody, it always fascinated me when I saw couples who were in their golden years You know, they've been married 30, 40 years and they were getting divorced. And the standout problem was that their lack of their partner's reliability was what would bring the relationship undone. They realized at this point where you would normally become more dependent on your partner. If you had a partner who was not reliable, who wasn't there for you when you needed them, when you were sick, or when somebody else was maybe giving you a hard time socially, they actually realized that getting older with somebody like that was actually a burden they were taking into their old age, not a benefit. And they would actually walk away from a relationship that had been around for so long. So reliability is one of the absolute key things. And we can absolutely see how somebody deals with that in terms of replying to messages. If they're going to cancel, how much notice do they give you? Do they make efforts to reorganize alternative dates? There's a whole range of things we can look for there.
Is this a variation, Shivani, on what I refer to when I talk to students about the tummy test, that actually if you intuitively feel as though you're being lied to, or indeed people are being economical with the truth, you really should actually give these folk a wide berth?
Yeah, I think it's important to notice if you are feeling different sensations, different uncertainties come up around whether or not someone's being honest with you. Our intuition can quite often be on point. One caveat I would put in there, though, is particularly if we recognize that we have a fear of intimacy, that can often lead us to run away from perfectly good relationships and find reasons why someone that we're dating who could actually be a good match for us might not actually be a good match for us. So we've got to be a little bit careful there of knowing where our limitations are. And this is why it's really good to, draw upon the wisdom of people who know you well, whether that's your friends or your family, being willing to let them meet a potential partner before it gets too serious. And be open to their feedback, because what often happens is people date someone one-on-one, date after date after date, until they think, okay, this is serious. All right, now I'm going to introduce them to my family or my friends. And by that time, they've already made up their minds, so they don't want to hear any feedback from the people that they trust or that know them well. They don't want to hear the truth often. So we need to be honest with ourselves around that. And I think it's a good idea to start thinking about introducing a potential date to people that you trust, as long as they're not jaded or bitter in love, sooner rather than later.
George, that's a couple of key points there, jaded or bitter. I mean, I'm sure there are an awful lot of people who might be listening to this and say, yes, that's all very well for George and Shivani to actually talk about this, but I lost my parents a good few years ago. I haven't got any friends. It's all a disaster. Would you say you need to take baby steps and actually start, putting yourself out there slowly but surely if you are seeking a full-time relationship?
And look, that's a fair point, Alex. There are people who don't have those people around that they can turn to. But this is where time does tell. Now, one of the very standout pieces of research here is that if we get married after less than 12 months of dating somebody, then the divorce rate is much higher than if we wait, one to 2 years. But if we wait actually 3 or more years, the rate of divorce is almost half the rate of divorce for people who get married in under 12 months. And what we're just simply seeing here is that the truth comes out over time as to who people are and how good they are for you. Because what we're really looking for is somebody who can bring out the best in us. And of course, we need to be working to bring out the best in them. And time does tell. So one of the very simple things we can do is we can just slow things down, not make decisions like get married or, even more problematically, have children during the infatuation phase. We need to wait until that passes. And that's typically, 6 to 18 months. Moving in together is a good way to bring the honeymoon phase to an end, by the way.
Again, one is mindful of the old statement, marry in haste, repent at leisure. I mean, presumably that has a lot of echoes in this particular strategy. Talk about obviously 7 steps that we can look at, and we've looked at some of those already in terms of the 7 steps from that point of view. What about the 7-year itch? Is that something which is a mythology, or is that something else that you kind of think, well, yeah, after a time you need to keep freshening up relationships, otherwise they will fossilize and ultimately die?
Absolutely. The 7-year itch actually is reflected in the data. It is the first big point of divorce frequency. And that typically occurs 7 years for most marriages is around the time when they've had typically their second child. And there's a lot of pressure on the partners to also develop their careers. And during this time, the relationship often gets lost. The number of couples I've had to get to start dating each other around that time period, they live under the same roof. They think that they're having an intimate relationship, but it's surprising how little true vulnerability and connection and intimacy is occurring. And so what I have to do is get couples to actually re-engineer, reconnecting, becoming vulnerable, finding out where each other is at. In fact, the research also shows that it takes around 14 years to get to the marriage that we got married for. And that's because it takes that long for us to really work out how to work well with a partner a lot of the time.
I'm reminded of the old E.M. Forster quote, only connect, which is particularly significant and regularly seems to work through that. Ultimately, Heavening, is it all about the communication side of things? Is that the big takeaway, that actually if you don't communicate, you can actually be heading for problems?
Well, see, I have as Jim touched on, I have a problem with the word communicate because it's just too simple. It doesn't convey two big complexities. One we've already spoken about, which is vulnerability. That is different from communicating. You know, I've treated, you know, very eloquent, articulate, professional people who were great communicators, but they weren't really connecting because they weren't being vulnerable and they weren't looking at what their deeper concerns was. But the second one is conflict. A lot of people think that conflict in a relationship is a bad thing. The reality is it's conflict that grows a relationship. So couples need to learn to fight well with respect, because all of the growth in the relationship, or certainly the vast majority of it, will actually come out of the conflict. The conflict tells you where to go and how to grow the relationship and make it better. So it's actually about embracing our differences, respecting our differences. We marry partners because they're different from us. They're complementary. Opposites do attract, but that does result in more conflict. And that's what's something we have to invite into the relationship to be managed.
We've cited 42% of marriages in the UK end in divorce. Culturally, do these change? I mean, I can see the notion of arranged marriages and aspects relating to colleagues in countries in Asia and so on, actually saying that that's a much better chance of success because everything's planned out for you. I mean, Shivani, is that something which maybe it's a bit like you need to hand over the whole chore of seeking a partner to elders who know much better?
I interviewed, for my research, a Pakistani guy, and I asked him how he felt about a matchmaker, but his aunts, his mother, of course, and the other person's, you know, relatives, all choosing his future partner. His response was, of course, all of these people should choose my partner. What would I know about these things? I'm only 35 years old. And he was talking about tapping into this time-honored wisdom around matchmaking. Sorry, Jim, you want to add something there?
I'm just going to say one of the biggest differences that people who go into arranged marriages and people who go into love marriages have is their mindset. And the mindset of people with love marriages is often along the lines of, oh, this feels good. There's love here in terms of feelings. And they bank on that. And then eventually those feelings, they fade, or they come and they go. They're not constant, right? Whereas when you are entering an arranged marriage, there's a foundation of an understanding that you're not relying on feelings. Instead, you're actually going to build the relationship together. And it's that mindset that we have found is actually the fundamental piece to the success that underpins those arranged marriages.
That's right. We're not suggesting we go back to arranged marriages, but they have a lot to teach us. Divorce rates in even the modern arranged marriages, less than 10%. And as we've said earlier, actually higher ratings of marital satisfaction over time.
Of course, you do realize that this book will mean the end for the Las Vegas wedding. I mean, it could actually be, you know, horrendous in terms of that, waking up overnight, suddenly married to somebody you've actually fallen in love with literally 24 hours ago.
If that happens, Alex, we'll be very, very happy.
Well, there you
go. We're going to put a few Elvis lookalikes out of business.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, could be a disaster from that point of view. Okay, the book is How to Make the Biggest Decision of Your Life, Unlocking the Secrets to a Healthy, Lasting Relationship. Presumably available on all good online services and book areas and so on.
Yep, absolutely.
Let's go straight away to Heavening in this. Of those top seven, which would you say, if you were to prioritize, would be the number one element that you'd look for in terms of that? I mean, I realize it might be difficult to select one from those seven, but which one would you say might be the most important one for yourself?
I think the willingness to be vulnerable, testing that is so important. Or actually reliability comes in there. You're right. It's difficult to pick one. I think a good one to start with is reliability, because you can see that pretty clearly through one's actions. And we really want to be looking for consistency of character. And as we've spoken about, vulnerability would be up there as well. Maybe it's a tie.
Actually, the other one I would throw into the mix is a preparedness to look to the future and think about making decisions around what life looks like in 1 year, 2 year, 5 years. You know, we know that this is the key to people being successful at anything in life, and that preparedness to consider the long-term implications of a decision has no greater application than when it comes to choosing a partner.
It tends to actually apply the triangle of life to students I've recommended in the past, which is enthusiasm, reliability, and a reasonable amount of talent. Maybe you could actually substitute the talent for actually just having vulnerability as well in this particular side of things. So it's another issue. But it's been fascinating, getting an interesting flavour in terms of that. Thank you both for obviously taking part in the programme from that point of view. Dr. George Blair West, medical doctor, specialised in psychiatry for the last 25 years, and indeed Dr. Shivani Blair West, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on, and hopefully we'll speak again in the not too distant future.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. See you, Alex.
Well, certainly thanks to two Australian psychologists there for some fascinating insight in terms of when you should actually have a relationship. Don't start until you're over 25. Interesting whether you would have the patience of a dead man to actually cope with that. And perhaps our next author, of course, the author of the week, will actually have one or two things to say with respect to this whole scenario. Of course, he was raised in New Hampshire, lived in the house that the patience of a dead man is based. It's the awesome Michael Clark. How are you, Michael?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to connect with yourself. And we're reaching you whilst you're in Massachusetts, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. I'm in Haverhill, Massachusetts. I'm on the border of New Hampshire.
Yeah, much beloved in terms of spelling bees, in terms of spelling Massachusetts. There are all sorts of ways there, but I won't even go into the challenges of that, because after all, we have on this side of the Atlantic things like Leicestershire, Worcestershire, and various other aspects equally challenging.
Yeah, we have all the ones you do, because this is, after all, it's New England. I went to England. I saw, you know, Chelmsford. I saw everything. You know, we have all those just like you do.
Yeah, there we are. You see, it's amazing. You'd think we were on the same planet, but, you know, that's all one part of the whole thing.
Exactly.
Michael, let's jump straight into this side of things as Jessica joins us and signs up. She's based in Dublin at present. The patience of a dead man. Talk us through this whole system. I mean, the lovely descriptor of the bats of the barn circled the rafters all day, and there was a man-made grove hidden in the forest. Talk us through the whole essence of this. Is the first three novels, The Patience of a Dead Man, Dead Woman Scorned, and Anger is an Acid.
Yeah, that's right. It's a trilogy, and it's based on a property that I lived on as a kid in New Hampshire. We did have a pond. It was a farmhouse. It had a big barn, and the bats circled the ceiling inside, you know, all year long almost. And there was a hidden grove in the woods, like a, I don't know if it was a tree farm or something or whatever, but you'd be walking through the woods and all of a sudden all the rows of trees would be perfect, and it was kind of an eerie feeling. It was like, you know, a creepy hallway. You were alone usually, you know, either that or my brother or something, and it really it lent a nice setting for the book. And do you want me to go into the book too, or?
I think we'll touch base on that, but I'll hand over to Jessica now. Jessica is midway between us, really. Actually, closer to England than currently with her base in Dublin, although she's from North Carolina originally. Jessica, any questions for Mike?
I would love to know about your characters and how you start to kind of characterize them. How do they come to you?
Well, I started with Tim. Tim is a divorcing or a divorced man, and I was a divorced man, so that was kind of easy. And I needed to get him out in the country somewhere where he's isolated. He's a handyman. He decides to buy a house in the middle of nowhere and then fix it up. And he has help from his real estate agent, whose name is Holly, and they end up being the two that have to kind of like find their way to peace, because the house is haunted in many ways. So yeah, I definitely he was me, for to begin with, and he's the main character. He's 80% of it.
Are there any characters that you find start to kind of be mysterious to you and you take a lot longer to get to know them?
As I write, yes. I mean, this Patience of a Dead Man was my first book. I started late. I started it, I don't know what I was, like 52 or something. I'm 57 now. And, I think that some of the characters are probably not as developed as they should be. And I'm realizing that more and more as I go. I just finished another book. It's this picture behind me over here. It's called Hell on High. And I went through a publisher this time. The first three were self-published. And I had an editor, and it was just such a luxury. I worked with MJ Pankey, and she was just, it was so good. She'd call me out when I needed to be called out. And I don't think I'll ever go back to self-pub after that. So she helped a lot.
I love the descriptor of Patience of a Dead Man. Tim Russell had it all until his wife filed for divorce. Now he's a free man with a dwindling bank account. Searching for inspiration, he invests in a fixer-upper farmhouse in New Hampshire, betting on himself and his construction background to live there as he fixes it up, then sell at a profit. But who is the woman in the field? And who flies the red kite? Might these things have something to do with the previous owner's death? Almost immediately, Tim realizes that buyer's remorse is the least of his problems. Is Tim a character that you would basically go out and have a beer with? Or is he basically somebody that you think, oh, I just don't know? I mean, how did you relate to him as you were creating him?
Well, as I said, he's kind of based on me, and I like beer. So yeah, let's go out for a beer. yeah, he's a working class guy, small business owner. He had to go down to one other employee, him and one other guy when he got divorced. His wife got, they had to split it up, obviously, split up all the assets and the money and everything. So, he's, like I said, he's betting on himself to start over. So, yeah, he's an everyman, he's an upper middle class, and then divorce brought him right back down to like, I could lose it all.
Yeah, you see, I knew I was right actually going to Australia when we started this particular hour of the program off to actually get some relationship advice. And the key takeaway is don't get involved until you're at least over 25. Anyway, that's by the by. Brains are still forming then, apparently. Anyway, moving on. We're focusing on yourself today, Michael. It's fair to say you were a relatively late entrant into the writing profession. But you've done extremely well, very successfully from that point of view. Was writing something you always had in the back of your mind, you really quite liked to do it? Or was it something that actually you thought, yeah, I might as well do a bit of writing now?
Exactly. It was that. It was in the back of my mind. And it's not such a big thing anymore with passwords, but they make you answer secret questions if you forget your password, like random websites will. And one of them was, what is your dream career? And I would always put writer, because, you can be famous. Not that I am, but you could be, and not be.
Michael, you are the official Southside and Siren Radio author of the week. I mean, sometimes it doesn't get much better than that. It's just another step in the direction to world domination. Jessica, we know, is going to write the 21st century equivalent of the great American novel. So, it's going to happen. We know this.
Right. Well, for now, I'm incognito. And I don't know if the radio audience can see me, but if they can't, then that goes along with my theory.
Yeah, well, you see, they'd have to go to the Facebook page and see the images we'll put up. That's the key thing on that basis. Anyway,
exactly.
Was it a joy or was it a chore when you were actually writing? I mean, because sometimes if you always wanted to be a writer, you could say, well, this is great. But actually the mechanics of getting the words out onto the either the page, the manuscripts, the computer screen. What were the moments, or did it actually flow? I mean, it's a trilogy, so one suspects that actually there was a fair amount of pre-idea that was actually there that you wanted to kind of formulate and actually get into the system.
Well, it is a joy once you make it to the desk. You know, like, I have another job. It's this writing does not support me at this point. So, you know, it's a struggle just to get to the desk. They say just write 1,000 words a day, but really, it, for me, like, I need to unwind. I need to kind of, like, you know, enter the book again. And if I have already written, if, like, say I'm halfway through and I haven't written in a week or two or something, I need to reacquaint myself with it too. You know, I need to read, like, the last chapter at least, just to get, you know, in the flow. So, you know, when you have a family and another job and everything, it takes a while to get in there. But once you get there, it's great. I mean, it's peaceful, and I really do enjoy it, especially when the flow is going, you know, like, but a big part of my writing is I write an extensive outline. Like, I don't want to be in the middle of the book and then have it start to go in a direction that I don't like, and maybe I can't think of the ending or a satisfactory ending. So before I even start putting words on the page, I've got, like, a spreadsheet, and I make sure that I at least like that. And that always changes too, but that's kind of a struggle too. But you can work on that when you're walking the dog or something. You know, you can bounce thoughts around and then just make notes, and of course you can sort with a spreadsheet and that kind of thing. So that takes a long time for me. Excuse me. But that's definitely part of it. But yeah, I do enjoy, once you finally get to the desk, it's peaceful.
And for the technology of writing, I mean, this is something we're finding, a bit like people liking vinyl and going back to LPs and so on. We're finding more and more writers actually saying, you know, I quite like pen and paper. I like to actually make notes there, and sometimes I actually use longhand. Are you somebody who basically uses that traditional mode, or would you say, no, it's got to be on the computer screen, it's got to be typing on that keyboard?
It's got to be on the computer screen for me. But I've heard, like, extremes where, you know, for one, like, writing out longhand, I don't know how you do that. And then, you know.
Well, I think Dickens managed it, and he had a quill pen. So, you know.
I don't think I would have been a writer then. I don't know. I mean, I need a little bit of technology. But then on the other hand, I've also heard of people that have written books on cell phones, which, that's too far. I mean, I couldn't do that. I don't know how you edit on that either. But imagine, well,
there is, of course, the notion of vocal recognition software, where effectively you dictate the text and the manuscript to the system as well. That's also, and I think the spelling is getting slightly better, although it has to be said, when I look at some of the things that I've had dictated in terms of lectures, I didn't say that. But anyway, that's by the by. Jessica, back to you.
I'd love to know what your inspirations were for this and what kind of books you enjoy reading in your free time.
I like horror, and not every kind of horror though. You know, I'm not big on, like, slashers or anything like that. I'm looking for eerie. Like, I want the goosebumps, you know, not literally the series goosebumps, but I like to feel the hair rise up on the back of my neck, and it's rare to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it's hard to find a book that'll do that. And, that's why I started writing, because I'm just, you know, like I said, I'm in my 50s and I'm old enough to have seen, for instance, Batman rebooted 800 times, or they remake a horror movie. You know, like, why remake a horror movie? Let's try some of the new horror stories. You know, there's tons of writers writing right now, which I didn't know that either, because they're not given a chance to become famous. You know, it's like Stephen King and nothing else, pretty much in bookstores. And then there's a whole horror community that exists that put out some great stuff. And so I'm kind of, like, trying to explore that now that I've found it.
What you suggested there, Mike, seems very reminiscent of the situation in the music industry, where you have your Harry Styles, you have your Beyonce, and then you have an awful lot of very, very good musicians who don't perhaps get the exposure that maybe they deserve.
Well, you have to be, like, a social media, you know, king. You know, you have to get your own followers. You know, this is the day, you know, the day and age when you can't even get an agent unless they look and they see that you've got an audience. You know, so, like, one of the girls, Sophie Turner, like, she was getting up for the X-Men role of Jean Grey, and she beat out another girl because she had more followers. You know, it's that's what they bet on. They bet on how many people are you going to bring to, you know, to this book, to this movie, whatever.
I like to celebrate the fact that Jessica doesn't have a Facebook account, so that's all good, you know. So yeah, it's important. You know, so
that's better for your brain.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, Jessica, back to yourself.
Yeah, I was really curious about how you kind of build your settings, because you were talking about how you like atmosphere. I feel like those kinds of horror stories where the horror is based on the atmosphere and how it makes you feel, that ominous feeling that something's about to happen. Do you deliberately go about creating your settings and atmosphere for your novels, or do you find that they kind of come naturally?
Both. It's got to, like, Patients of a Dead Man is a haunted house story, basically. I never even realized it was, but it's a haunted house. That's a haunted property, whatever. And that one was kind of easy because I walked that property. You know, I knew the house like the back of my hand. I even snuck back onto the property to look around and trespassed. And that was surreal too. But for this one, for Hell on High, It begins in Brazil, and my wife is Brazilian, so I know a little bit about Brazil. And it's about a woman that she has to flee Brazil because something bad happened. She has to leave her sister behind, and she gets a job in the United States. And her job is to basically, she's saving to save the sister, saving money to pay for her passage to the United States. And she has a talent for hiking and mountain climbing, and she meets a guy through this hobby that knows somebody. And this is takes place in the 70s. So eventually she's offered the opportunity to become the first woman to climb Mount Everest. So there's a whole chunk of the book, like more than a third, that's on Mount Everest, and I've never climbed Mount Everest. But thank God there's a, you know, thank God for YouTube, because you can research the heck out of stuff. I mean, I've hiked to the base camp via, you know, eight different people, you know, with their videos and stuff. I've flown the plane from Kathmandu to Lukla, which is this hair-raising little postage stamp, like on the base of a cliff, and put that into my book, you know. So yeah, that's part of the feel and the eeriness and the, I try to capture that, and I hope I do. You know, that's definitely, atmosphere is everything.
Now, out of curiosity, with the haunted house, do you believe in ghosts?
I don't think I do. It would be cool. I fell asleep on the couch last night and nobody was home. And then something made a noise in the kitchen, and I was like, what the hell? You know, so I was a little, you know, on alert. I didn't think it was an intruder or anything, but I was like, that's weird and it's creepy. So I do get scared of those moments of solitude, you know, when something happens that shouldn't happen.
It's the atmosphere.
Yeah, I agree.
I've got to say, I'm very impressed, Mike, that you're actually wearing a Brazilian yellow t-shirt as well.
Yes,
which is always very impressive.
What is it? Happiness is reading a book.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. That says everything. I mean, we sort of contrast again the notion of people's fears, people's concerns. I mean, we're living in a world which clearly is replete with challenges, tragedies, all manner of things, whether you're an earthquake victim, whether you're a victim of war and so on. Mindful, actually, one of the other shows we actually do and Jessica's key part of is a show called Resonance Rewind. And we're looking at what could arguably be seen as a horror. Currently, which is basically Village of the Damned, children with scary eyes.
Oh yeah.
From that perspective, do you feel that actually it might be arachnophobia, fear of spiders? It might be fear of open spaces, agoraphobia. You know, it might. You know, where from the point of view of the horror writing do you think is most effective, or which aspects do you like to explore, or would you wish to explore?
I think I want to stay with the eerie and creepy as long as I can, because like I never even realized that, you know, there were so many subgenres that there's cryptids, you know, Bigfoot and stuff like that. The kids that are behind you there, it scares the heck out of me. But arachnophobia, not so much, you know, like I'm not afraid of monsters, you know, like there are very few. That's hard to get right, because think of the movie Alien, you know, like if they didn't have H.R. Giger's art, you know, like I've seen concept art for what they might have done. And it's just if it doesn't nail it, you know, you're in trouble. And if, especially in a book where you're relying on the reader's imagination, you know, like I know it, Stephen King's It was a big, you know, hit, but it wasn't for me. And I think it was the last book of his I read, you know, because it's got creatures in it and stuff. I like the clown, you know, that was cool. But give me ghosts and even like black magic and witches, you know, those are my top two.
Clowns used to be very friendly, of course. I think there was a period, probably thanks to Stephen King in the 1980s, where suddenly they switched from being, you know, reasonably okay folk to the equivalent of psycho versions of Sideshow Bob, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's they've been done and overdone, and I don't think I'll ever write a clown story. You know, it's just, you know, we've seen it, and it's been done well.
We often ask folk, do you have a particular soundtrack that you like to write to? I suspect the answer might be no, if you like total solitude and quiet. Or is there an aspect of music or other things that you help find inspiring? You've said, obviously, walking the dog, which is obviously a nice physical activity to work through on that basis. Do you have a secret sort of penchant for, a soundtrack to Mary Poppins, for instance?
I have a killer soundtrack. I have a Spotify playlist. It's got 800 plus songs on it, and it's all movie soundtracks, horror movie soundtracks. And not, well, some of them are not. Some of them are like, it might, like a, there's a button you can click that says enhance, and then they add some things that are like it. And I might get a, like a drama in there or something. It can't be something that, you know, interrupts me, but a nice, eerie, creepy soundtrack is a must, really. I mean, like, I couldn't listen to classical music or something. It's too happy, you know. I have to be on the edge of being afraid, you know, to be that person that I'm writing about, you know, in the book. So yeah, I have a great set list I use, and I'm always looking for more things to add to it.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure I'd necessarily say that classical music is all happy. I mean, there are certain sort of Requiem masses, for instance, which would be quite sad, really, in their own sort of way. But, you know,
yeah. If I knew that better, like if I was better up on classical music, I'd be like, oh, I need some of that, and that. But yeah, I don't.
So, John Carpenter soundtrack, Halloween, is that something?
Oh yeah, that's in there. You know, yeah. The Fog, and you know, I've got a lot of his, you know, I think They Live maybe is in there, but
maybe yeah. The John Carpenter remake of Village of the Damned, perhaps.
I don't, it maybe Spotify put that in there. Or it's yet to be discovered by me. I don't know, but I'll check that out.
Let's talk transmedia storytelling. Nice fancy phrase. Would you like to see your trilogy and indeed the upcoming latest text adapted as audio plays, as screenplays, as series? Are there any thoughts about that? Or is it a case of, no, I'm going to keep the patience of a dead man and Anger is an Acid and Hell on High as books? You have to read them, not watch them.
No, I definitely want a movie. You know, that's been the goal. I think I'm more of a movie guy than I am a reader. You know, I'm kind of one-dimensional as a reader. I like reading, but, you know, now that I'm a writer, I see people that read my books that are just pounding books out, you know, Bookstagram, whatever. I mean, they're one after the other. And kind of like writing, I need to settle in and have the right atmosphere and be able to pick up the book and have it suck me in. But if, you know, in the days where your watch will snap you out of something, you know, it's kind of hard. But anyway, I'm still plowing through with the reading. But I used to be the guy before iPhones and all that stuff that would see a book on the shelf like Jurassic Park that says soon to be a major motion picture. And I'm like, boom, I'm going to read it just before. And then I'm going to go see the movie. Did that with The Silence of the Lambs too. That's my sweet spot. And when I write because I know that screenplays have a, you know, a slim chance to make it to be a movie. And I don't know how to write a screenplay, and I don't know how you get followers from writing a screenplay. So I'm like, you know, the next best thing is I can write a book and hope, cross my fingers, that one day it becomes a movie. But Paul Tremblay, who is also in Massachusetts, I don't know him, but I've at least talked to him a couple times on Twitter. He just had M. Night Shyamalan make his movie, The Cabin at the End of the World, into The Knock at the Cabin. So, you know, I'm looking at that, I'm going, oh, that looks pretty good.
Well, Michael Crichton obviously benefited from a certain Mr. Spielberg actually helping with Jurassic Park. And he had obviously had Westworld before then and Coma. So, you know, he was a medical doctor who basically fancied doing a bit of writing. So it was all good.
Coma was Robin Cook, I think.
Was it?
Yeah.
Was it not based on Michael Crichton?
He had the Andromeda Strain, I think.
Michael. Yes, that certainly was. I thought Coma was also a Michael Crichton number. Never mind, that's okay. We will sort of find that out. We'll use the.
That's
magical
the only
routine.
Time I'm going to be outdo you with anything related to a book. That was a chance in hell right there.
It's all good. Let's talk a little bit about Hell on High. We've talked about The Patience of a Dead Man. How does Hell on High differ from your early trilogy?
Well, I kind of look at it as my sophomore effort, and I wanted to avoid the sophomore slump. I also just, you know, I didn't realize it until starting to write it that, hey, this is not a haunted house, you know, like it just, I start writing. I'm like, this is what I want to do. Boom, boom, boom. The inspiration was the bodies that they leave on Everest. You know, somebody dies up there. Maybe nowadays it's a little different, but bodies became landmarks that other hikers would walk past as the, you know, and they're frozen solid, and that creeps me out. So that was the inspiration. And then again, I realized that it wasn't a haunted house, and that the tension of a haunted house isn't always there. I mean, if she's not in the death zone at the top of the mountain where everybody dies, then it doesn't read like a horror story sometimes, you know? So yeah, like, am I straying from the question?
No, I think I think it's perfect. I mean, it's also allowed me to do a double check. And actually, you're quite right. Coma, the 1978 film, was indeed based on a 1977 novel by Robin Cook. But it was actually, the movie was written by Michael Crichton and also directed by Michael Crichton. So I knew there was a Michael Crichton connection with Coma.
At least
we've managed to sort that one out there. It's always great to get these things identified. So there we are. Robin Cook wrote the book, Michael Crichton bought it, and then he rewrote it for the movie.
Okay, we both win. I love it.
I feel as though it's a special relationship writ large with Jessica as the referee. It's fantastic.
Perfect.
So, yeah, Hell on High again. Immediately when I saw that, I thought, Hell or High Water. Was there any kind of notion that you'd be using that to kind of work through the thing, or was that just a different angle?
No, in fact, whenever I, you know, it's not out yet. It comes out March 9th. It is a pre-order right now. If you have a Kindle, I'm just going to plug something. It's 99 cents or, you know, less than a pound, obviously. But so it's not out yet. And I, when I go to search for it in Amazon, I always see Hell or High Water. So I'm going to have to overcome that, I guess. But no, it was a back and forth between me and a booktuber. His name's Kevin Witten. He goes by Well Read Beard. And he helped me. He was like a beta reader. And my original title was The Ghost 5 Miles Up. And I, you know, I over time, like, I don't know. And then, you know, he and I are going back and forth. And I was second to last because he nailed Hell on High. But mine was Hell is a High Place. And then he said Hell on High. So we went with that. It's nice. It's simple. It rolls off the tongue. And then since I've, you know, been starting to promote it on Instagram and so forth, there's a hashtag Hell on High. And I'm like, oh, are they talking about my book? And No, it's a beer. Somebody made a beer called Hell on High. So at least it's beer.
Well, that's true. I mean, well, whilst we're talking about marketing, I'm fascinated by the fact that I know, obviously, conventions, events, authors and autographed books, fine. But you actually offer free autographed bookmarks.
Yes, I do.
So share with us, why did you decide to actually offer autographed bookmarks as opposed to the books?
Well, I want you to buy the book. Exactly. No, I do have autographed books on my website too. Okay. But, you know, it just gets into shipping. And here we have Amazon Prime. I you probably do too. You know, so if you're
The whole world has Amazon Prime, actually.
Okay. Yeah. But Brazil doesn't. They have Amazon, but not. I just know that from my wife. But because I always felt, why do I do this? Because I always liked when your celebrity that you like is reachable, you know, is attainable. They can talk to you if they mention, you can talk to them on Twitter or go to a concert and they throw you a guitar pick or something like that. It's like a special souvenir just for you, you know, as opposed to buying, you know, a poster or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I offer autographed book plates and bookmarks. I've even got a print of Hell on High. I know most people probably can't see this, but that's what the wraparound.
Well, if you just keep holding it up, actually, and hold it up one more time, yeah, I'm sure we'll actually get a good shot of the whole thing and get that sort of done and dusted. Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll mail those worldwide. It costs me a couple bucks, but if you buy the book and then I'm in it for the long haul kind of a thing, you know, like for now it's a hobby. I don't golf and I don't ski, so I don't put my money into that. I'm just going to put my money into this, what could be a career someday. And just want to be attainable for people that like my books.
Well, I was talking to one of my colleagues and we were saying about the Author of the Week feature. And I pointed out that we like to feature authors at various levels of their development, from newbies through to seasoned pros, through to folk who are sort of working throughout in all genres. And it's been a delight to share some thoughts with yourself. However, we've reached the two final questions, which are critical ones, and Jessica's going to put them to you. So are you ready for this, Mike? Are you okay?
Because I don't know. I'm nervous.
Okay. Jessica, question one.
Yes, Mike, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Have I had one?
Yes, have you had a reasonably interesting one?
Reasonably, more than that. I've had a blast.
Fantastic. That's good. So will you join us again soon?
Yes.
There you are. Michael Clark has said yes, which is brilliant from that point of view. Of course, reminder, michaelclarkbooks.com, presumably the best place to go to actually find out about the text, or would you recommend going to a social media site, Mike?
Well, yeah, michaelclarkbooks.com. If you want a free bookmark or one of these prints or something, michael@michaelclarkbooks.com. And then I also have one of those, it's not Linktree, but it's sleek.bio/Michael Clark Books. So
fantastic.
It's got all the links, Twitter, all that stuff.
Enjoy the rest of the day in Massachusetts and all will be well.
All right. Have a nice evening over there.